Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Nelson Mandela was 95 years old when he died this afternoon. The economics of ending apartheid on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 5th of December. Great, as always, to have you with us. South African President Jacob Zuma made the announcement this afternoon. Nelson Mandela has passed away at the age of 95. Mandela was the president of South Africa from 1994 to 1999, elected after 27 years in prison. His imprisonment set off a massive international movement to stop apartheid in South Africa. And by that movement's peak in the late 1980s, hundreds of governments, along with American universities and pension funds, had pulled billions of dollars out of South Africa and helped fatally undermine the apartheid regime. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
It took decades for Nelson Mandela and his African National Congress to overthrow apartheid. In addition to guerrilla warfare and popular resistance inside the country, a key tactic was to stop the flow of goods and investment from outside. William Minter is editor of Africa Focus.
The ANC actually very strategically reached out to the international anti-apartheid movement, including divestment, sanctions, boycotts.
In the foreword to Minter's book on African liberation, Nelson Mandela wrote that American activism was crucial, from college divestment to economic sanctions passed by Congress. Minter says it all added to the cost of staying in South Africa.
We called it an apartheid tax. The popular action made it less profitable for companies to invest because they had all the hassle. So even those that stayed in, like Shell Oil, they began to put pressure on the South African government.
And many investors did bail, including the massive pension funds run by the University of California and New York City, plus J.P. Morgan and Chase Manhattan Bank. Billions of dollars were pulled out of companies doing business in South Africa. The currency collapsed and inflation soared. The impact of divestment was also profound in the U.S. Sarah Willie LeBreton teaches black studies at Swarthmore College. She pushed for divestment as a student at Haverford College in the 1980s.
My role was not the same as Nelson Mandela's role, but my role was part of being student of color on a predominantly white campus in an overdeveloped nation that could say, what is our complicity in this?
I think we see the legacies of the anti-apartheid campaign everywhere.
University of California Irvine sociologist David Meyer says divestment helped localize a struggle against oppression 8,000 miles away. And the tactics have been imitated. Activists put up mock South African shanty towns.
And that's what we saw with the Occupy movement. And right now, Bill McKibben of 350.org is pushing for a divestment on campuses from companies that do business in fossil fuels.
Decades before climate change hit the radar, though, Nelson Mandela and anti-apartheid activists were bringing global economic issues home to Americans through the divestment movement. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not that it really matters all that much given the context, it was down. Sad music when we get there. Here's what happens with a lot of big-ticket economic reports. You get a great headline number, like, say, today's announcement that gross domestic product was revised up to 3.6% last quarter, and you think, great, good news, let's move on. And then you drill down, and you realize not only is all not quite so well, but what's gone wrong could come back to bite us next quarter. Kate Davidson has that story.
The surge in growth came from businesses building up inventory, more than $116 billion of it. Stephen Buckles teaches economics at Vanderbilt University.
They were stocking up. They thought that spending was growing a bit faster than it actually did. So they increased production and they didn't sell all of their increased production.
And that's the catch. Increased production is good, but then you gotta sell the stuff. Randy Krosner is an economics professor at the Booth School of Business. He says, think about those companies like a family stocking up on frozen dinners.
And you put a lot of those into your freezer.
But suddenly, your kids aren't eating as much as you expected. Then you're stuck with shelves of Swedish meatballs.
next quarter, you're not going to be buying as many because you can just draw down all those in your freezer because you had so many stocked up.
Doug Handler is chief U.S. economist with IHS Economics. He says GDP will probably look pretty weak in the months ahead as companies try to sell off those inventories without buying more from producers. But he says just as today's headline number overstates the strength of the economy, those weak numbers in the near future will probably understate it.
You really want to get a gauge of what's happening. You need to subtract out these inventory changes here. You still eat one frozen food dinner per night here, and that's in fact what's important.
So eat up, America, because there's a lot of frozen fare to get through. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Closely related to that whole how quickly the economy grows or doesn't grow thing is this next item. Reports, early though they may be, of a budget deal in Washington. Small b, small d, there are no grand bargains to be had here. The key to the whole thing is going to be what Congress decides to call the mechanism by which it raises money. Taxes or fees? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at the economic semantics.
What's in a name anyway? A lot if you're a budget negotiator who's promised not to raise taxes and must avoid the T word at all costs.
We try not to call bad things by their names.
Anatoly Liberman teaches linguistics at the University of Minnesota.
Now the word fee is more marketable than the word tax.
But Liberman says they really mean the same thing. But surprise, surprise, politicians don't always say what they mean. The deal they're reportedly coming up with would replace some of the automatic sequestration spending cuts with revenues from fees, not taxes. John Pitney is a political science professor at Claremont McKenna College. He says there's a reason taxpayers can swallow fees better than a tax.
A fee is something you pay in order to get something from the government. Arguably, you get some kind of government service as a result of paying the fee.
The negotiators are reportedly considering a hike in airline fees to pay for security. Semantics can come in handy when Congress is as closely divided as it is now, when nobody's willing to give much in negotiations. Ross Baker teaches political science at Rutgers University.
It's in the interest of both sides to come up with a really good set of euphemisms, to be able to give themselves political cover in order to do what they want to do.
Even if it's just a modest agreement, which, Baker says, is about all we can expect. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The HBO series Tremé started its fourth and final season this week. It's set, of course, in New Orleans in the months just after Hurricane Katrina. The show doesn't take viewers all the way up to present-day Tremé, which is one of New Orleans' most historic neighborhoods. And like many parts of that city, Tremé is changing. Improvements promised when the levees failed 8 years ago are being delivered, which has brought new businesses and new home buyers. But at the same time, the Crescent City is still high on the blight list with tens of thousands of vacant properties. So what does it feel like to have a boom in the midst of blight? From New Orleans, Eve Tro reports.
About a year ago, Greg Tyson and Shakti Belway bought this 1800s double in the Tremé neighborhood.
I'm tall. I love the high ceilings and fireplace in every room and beautiful pocket doors.
Beauty, yes, but it needed work.
The floors had been eaten away by termites and, you know, were under layers and layers of linoleum.
But the couple, both with postgraduate degrees, knew they wanted to live here. It's so New Orleans, this historically African-American neighborhood just across Rampart Street from the French Quarter. Shakti, a California native, is 8 months pregnant. As she rides out a kick from the baby, I ask if this is where she sees the child growing up.
It is. It is. We think about that every day.
One thing they worry about, more people like them moving in.
I recognize that on one hand, I am gentrification. But on the other hand, I am against gentrification because I don't want this neighborhood to lose its magic.
That magic comes from second lines, for one. The traditional Sunday street parades often wind through Tremé. At the parade's endpoint, Patricia McDonald sells gumbo.
It's got shrimps, hot sausage, smoked sausage, chicken necks, and chicken gizzards.
The 34-year Treme resident had to move recently when the place she rented went up for sale. She felt lucky to find an apartment she could afford a few blocks away. She says many new owners convert historic doubles into single-family houses. That means fewer rental units. And the price tags send a message.
You trying to run us out of New Orleans. Out of here. You know, we can't afford $287,000.
She quotes the sale price of one nearby house. High dollar for what Treme is used to, but cheap if you're coming from Los Angeles or New York. And increasingly, says real estate agent Eric Wilkinson, people are.
This is by far and away the most active the market's ever been in at least the last decade. The most amount of people moving to New Orleans, buying in New Orleans.
He says New Orleans has joined the it list with cities like San Francisco and Austin, but cheaper. And those with fresh eyes have an advantage over natives.
I mean, when you call a street Rampart, which literally means barrier, and people grow up thinking don't go across Rampart Street, whereas people from out of town, they don't have those preconceived notions, and it makes it easier for them to take the leap of faith.
Not to mention most newcomers have no personal memory of the floods after Hurricane Katrina, which, interestingly, is part of why they're coming, even if they don't know it. $100+ billion of federal aid rebuilt the flood protection system and roads. With those in place, big projects like hospitals broke ground. That spread investor confidence for things like restaurants and retail. Take the historic St. Rock Market on St. Rock Avenue in a neighborhood called St. Rock. It sat empty for decades.
A year ago, it was boarded up, covered in graffiti. The bones of the building were still there. You could tell that it used to be something amazing, but it wasn't very pleasant to look at.
Sarah Chase is a St. Rock resident and New Orleans editor of Curbed, a national real estate blog. She shows me how the market building stands up straight, pure white inside, after a $3.7 million renovation. But this special space is luring special tenants, like fancy cheese and meat sellers. Some locals are nervous.
They don't want a gourmet market moving into their neighborhood, or they don't want something that they can't afford. At the same time, we live in a food desert.
The chain supermarket down the street didn't reopen after Katrina. And so you can wind up with an uneven patchwork, a beautifully restored Victorian next door to a boarded up mess, a place to buy a free-range chicken, but no regular grocery. The business and residential boom is mostly unfolding on urban higher ground, areas that had blight before Katrina but did not flood badly. The more suburban, deluged fringes of New Orleans now lag behind. That's where the working poor get pushed as historic areas gentrify. Treme homeowner Shakti Belway holds out hope for middle ground.
The very things that make this city so special could be lost, but it doesn't need to happen that way.
With the right policies and programs, she says, New Orleans can help longtime residents stay in their homes. That way, the city's oldest, most storied neighborhoods will hold on not just to their beautiful buildings, but a more delicate, precious asset, their culture. In New Orleans, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I mean, there's a lot of anticipation. It's been years since the first Anchorman. People love this character. It became a huge cult hit.
Don't act like you're not impressed. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, I think 5 days makes it so. The losing streak is official. The Dow Industrials sheared off 0.4%. Today, 68 points, closed at 15,821. The NASDAQ gave back 0.1%, 4 points, 4,033. The S&P 500 reversed 0.4%. That is 7 points, ended at 1785. Fears the Fed might ease its stimulus program in light of that GDP report today sent financial shares lower. Morgan Stanley dropped nearly 3%. JP Morgan Chase unloaded 2.3% today. The Black Friday backlash continued for retailers. Aeropostale unraveled 2.75% after lowering earnings estimates. Guess forfeited more than 2%. JCPenney lost more than 8%. Wet Seal slipped 13%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday.
It's the first Friday of the month, so in Washington, the Labor Department is scheduled to release employment data for November. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for October. And time for a celebration of convenience. Tomorrow is Microwave Oven Day. Stick a frozen entree in a box, slam the door, press some numbers, and presto! Grandma would be so proud. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. In New York today, Mayor-elect Bill de Blasio picked William Bratton as that city's next police commissioner. Before his latest gig, Mr. Bratton ran the police department here in Los Angeles, and before that, he ran the police department in New York City. Bratton replaces Ray Kelly, who is wrapping up his second gig running the NYPD. Bratton and Kelly are two of just a handful of names on the perpetual shortlist for big city police chief jobs, which is because why? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler went looking for answers.
The list of top cop candidates is a short one.
We usually look at a handful of individuals and sort of move them from one place to another.
Mackie Haberfeld is a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She has written books on police leadership and has met lots of promising leadership candidates.
There are female, there are minorities. The list is long.
If the list of good candidates is so long, why do the job searches focus on just a few names?
It's all about the political connections.
In the most political of cities, Washington, D.C., a woman is chief of police. But Haberfeld says that's just one city.
Unfortunately, we are still very much behind other professions, including the military.
Others believe the list for a new police chief is short because there aren't many qualified candidates. Jack Green is a criminal justice professor at Northeastern University.
So the population of people who might go for a job like New York is probably only coming from about 200 large police departments across the country.
Even if candidates have the leadership and law enforcement skills, they may not have the political savvy. They may not want to move to another city, or they may fear that moving will risk their current pensions. As a result, Green says,
there are only a handful of people that actually have really big city police experience.
Since the police chief often rivals the mayor in terms of public exposure, to want the job, you've got to be comfortable working in the public eye. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
When the Federal Reserve next meets in a couple of weeks, it will tell us where it thinks the economy is going and whether and when it's going to back off its policy of buying bonds to juice things up out there. To do that, to buy those securities, the Federal Reserve has been, and here's the technical phrase, expanding its balance sheet, creating money is another way to say it, to the tune of about $85 billion a month. We all kind of take that for granted now when the Fed does it, but Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains that the first time a central bank tried to do that, create more money, it didn't go over so well.
They were desperate times which required desperate measures.
So we're talking about a weekend in February 1797.
Stefan Eich is researching this for his PhD dissertation at Yale, and I asked him to grab a beer with me at the pub and take me back to late 18th century England.
It's a dramatic weekend that is preceded by a landing of French troops under American command and backed up with Irish insurgents on British shores. People are rightly concerned about the ability of the government to finance this war. There are mutinies going on all over the British fleet at the same time. And those kind of rumors cause bank runs to occur. There's a concern on the side of the wider population, as well as the Prime Minister and the Bank of England, that the bank is slowly but surely running out of gold reserves. The Prime Minister requests, and this is for the first time, requests the King to come into London for an emergency Privy Council meeting. And they announce something truly spectacular. They announce suspension of payment in gold.
Now, you have to understand how crazy this was at the time. All of a sudden, people were told their money, which they'd always believed to be backed by gold, was just backed by promises. Promises that the government would honor the money. Take it as taxes, for example. And the Bank of England could just create that money, whether it had gold or not. This is what we call fiat money.
It has worth because people trust in it having worth, rather than value being created by some kind of backing through metal or land or other kind of commodity.
So how did people
react to this when they woke up on Monday morning and all the banks opened? What happened?
It takes people by surprise. So you see, for the first 2 days, people scrambling to make sense of what has just happened. And there are voices that describe the experience of the weekend in truly dramatic terms.
The nefarious system of making paper pass for money, the power conferred upon the bank by this bill, is of a nature the most oppressive and dangerous that ever was conferred by the legislature of any country. The Iniquity of Banking, 1797.
The first day of our national bankruptcy.
Charles James Fox.
You hear some of these things from people today who are worried about what the Federal Reserve does. Back then, people had reason to worry. The American colonies tried taking their currencies off gold during their revolution, and they printed so much money that it quickly became worthless. They switched back to gold as soon as they could. This time, though, was different.
Very quickly, the established banking community, large parts of the political community, as well as the population, actually back the situation. It somehow avoids the bank runs that are feared. It enables the government to pay the troops. What happens to prices is nothing. For at least the first 2 years, prices barely move. So the immediate horror scenario doesn't happen.
What did happen was a certain amount of inflation, rising prices. By today's standards, it would have been modest, around 4%, but it definitely freaked them out at the time. And the central bank didn't know how to control it. They hadn't figured out interest rate manipulation or asset purchases. So after a quarter century of it, they brought back gold and threw in the towel on fiat money.
It's seen as something like a Pandora's box of monetary policy, something that is terrifying, powerful, and needs to be kept in check.
It would take 174 years before the world completely ditched gold. But by creating money, the Bank of England came close to running a situation like we have today, where the bank exists in this strange place between the government and the economy. And it raised a lot of the same basic questions about the role of the bank and the powers it wields, questions that are still asked today, 200 years later. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The big Christmas movie this year? Anyone? Anyone? Anchorman 2, of course. Unless you've been living under a rock, you've been unable to avoid the marketing. Ron Burgundy in the person of Will Farrell has been everywhere and then some. Sharon Waxman is the editor-in-chief of the entertainment news site The Wrap. Sharon, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Kai, nice to talk to you.
One does have to wonder, does one not, how long this Ron Burgundy marketing thing can go on. I mean, the guy's been out there forever, and the movie doesn't open for another 2.5 weeks.
I think it's hilarious and one of the funniest marketing campaigns I've seen. I mean, it started with him doing these Dodge commercials that were hilarious. We did some digging into that one because we thought that was sort of funny. And it turns out that it was the head of the car company and the head of marketing at Paramount came up with this idea to have him doing a sports car. And then they decided, you know what? How about like a truck?
Wow.
And they shot like 70 spots. So we are going to be continued to be bombarded with Ron Burgundy spots around the Durango truck. But these latest things he's doing, I think, are really kind of inspired. I mean, he's going to be hosting ESPN as Ron Burgundy.
Yep.
He just hosted the news in North Dakota.
So let me roll another phrase by you here and get your reaction. Jumping the shark, right? This movie comes out on the 20th. Here we are, the first week of December. Aren't people just going to get sick and tired of this guy?
Well, apparently you may get sick and tired of this guy. Could you tell? I think that the tracking is not indicating that.
Wow.
I mean, there's a lot of anticipation. It's been years since the first Anchorman.
Right.
People love this character. It became a huge cult hit. So people, I think, are excited to see this character. You could be right. I mean, we do have another 2.5 weeks, and I've been noticing now they're rolling out the paid campaign.
Yeah.
There's lots and lots of TV ads out there right now. I don't know. It's Hollywood. Overkill is like doesn't exist.
Well, but let me ask you about that, because the last time you and I talked, it was actually about marketing, and everybody knows marketing's important, and certainly, you know, they have to have this movie do well to make money enough to pay Will Ferrell's salary and Steve Carell and all those guys. But does this movie need all this marketing?
Well, that goes back to the adjective I used a minute ago, which is paid marketing.
Oh,
so when
yeah.
he's doing this KX thing in North Dakota, ESPN, I don't think they're paying. In fact, the Dodge thing, they're paying Will Ferrell.
No, really?
Paying Paramount. It's going the other way
laughing
around.
All
so
the
they're
way to
making
the bank,
money
baby.
Coming and going here.
Oh, man.
So I don't know if the
paid campaign is any bigger than the traditional budget that they'd spend. But what they're doing is very cleverly using the character for essentially free media.
And obviously that bit of it's paying off, right?
Yeah, because we're talking about it on the radio now.
Exactly. Sharon Waxman at The Wrap. Sharon, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
As we were talking about, Ron Burgundy's been showing up on newscasts everywhere. So let's just think big here, shall we? If you could choose an Anchorman character to host this broadcast with me, who do you like? Cast your ballot at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which your nickels and dimes add up to $500,000, $531,395.22 to be exact. That is how much money we all left behind at TSA checkpoints in airports last year. The House of Representatives passed a law on Tuesday that would direct all that money to nonprofit groups that work with veterans and their families. Miami, by the way, Miami International, was the most forgetful place. $39,000 left in change there. Guam had $170 left. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Dudgeon, Donathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.